This is Dan Galadner, Wayne State University, Walter P. Ruther Library. It's May 1st, 2007, talking with Louise Sundin, part of the AFT Oral History. Happy May Day.
Thank you. I think there's going to be some activities around the country this May Day.
I think they're rumoring that kind of stuff, yeah.
All centered around recent immigrants.
So we left off talking yesterday about charters, choice. Why don't we talk about how Edison, the MFT got an Edison grant?
Well, actually, yes, but that's a different story.
Okay.
But when we talk about magnets and federal grants that back in the late 80s, we were still getting and still occasionally get federal grants for magnet schools within the school district. And I wrote a federal magnet grant for a teaching magnet because we thought at that time we had a lot of recent immigrants from Laos and from Vietnam, primarily at that time from Vietnam, and other recent immigrants coming in who highly regarded teaching as a profession and highly regarded teachers. Teachers are right up there next to Confucius and some other highly regarded folk. And so we thought in order to increase the number of persons of color in the teaching force, we should start a teaching magnet high school so that we could capture young people in middle grades and convince them that and inspire them and stimulate them to think that maybe they'd like to be teachers. So we got that federal grant, and we placed it at Edison High School, Thomas Edison High School in Minneapolis. And the Edison High School teaching grant is still going. It's now gone through two name changes since then, as everything else does. But it's still going, and that is the students in the teaching magnet go to middle schools to encourage students to sign up for the teaching magnet at Edison. When they get to Edison, they get 2 years, the equivalent of a couple of years worth of introductory classes in teaching and other things with college credit. And then they get help with going to college, and they get the union gives each graduate a small stipend as an encouragement when they graduate to go on to college. And then if indeed they get their teaching degree, then they get preferential hiring coming back to the district. So we have some teaching magnet graduates who are now teaching in the district. So it worked to sort of grow our own, educate our own, create our own educators and bring them back into the district. We still, the other program that we have that we invented to train and attract persons of color is our Q program, Collaborative Urban Educator Program. And that is a program we did collaboratively with the University of St. Thomas, and where I'm on the advisory board, and where we did our own master's degree program. But the Q program is one in which we do an alternative licensure route for persons of color who are from the private sector. And they're either retiring in from something in the private sector, some private sector job, or many have become jaded with their work in the private sector. We have several attorneys who just plain don't think that attorneying or being an attorney is really what they thought it was going to be, and they want to do something in life to give back, and so they think that teaching is the thing they'd like to try. So we've been very successful. A couple of hundred graduates from that program have gone into the Twin Cities schools who through that collaborative urban educator program, and we've kept that going for over a decade. It's now focusing on special education. So we have tried in a number of ways to grow our own teachers, particularly since it's difficult for us to attract teachers of color from other parts of the country, particularly the South, to come up to Minnesota and to land in the, on the frozen tundra. And so since that's a tough sell, we just thought it would be more effective and to grow our own. So we have several programs in which we grow our own teachers, some who are previously paraprofessionals. We have several programs to encourage paraprofessionals to get their degrees and then their teaching license. And we have several paraprofessionals who are now teaching in the district. One, I think, who's a principal in the district, maybe more than one. So those programs in collaboration with various colleges and universities in the metro area have been pretty successful in bringing persons of color into the district. Now, that doesn't mean that we have nearly enough. Oh, I have one story, too, about the one of our programs to bring students of color from historically black colleges into teaching in Minneapolis, where we took young people who were doing their student teaching and brought them into Minneapolis to do their student teaching or internship, whatever they were doing. And that would give us an opportunity to try to convince them that this wasn't such a terrible place after all, and maybe that they ought to stay here. So I remember one young woman, actually she went to the historically black college, but she was from Detroit originally, so it wasn't such a hard sell. And when she was here, I thought, well, I'm going to personally help out this program. So I gave her one of my cars to drive while she was here, because I thought that would be helpful. So the first snowfall, big snowfall, she was going over to the University of Minnesota to take her GRE and graduate record exam. It was on a Saturday morning, and it was the snow was coming down pretty good. And wouldn't you know, she ran into a snowplow with my car. So it tested my my conviction as to supporting the program, but I had the thing put back together again, but I didn't go that far after that to sacrifice an automobile to the program.
But it showed dedication.
It, well, for temporarily. We also had, we were going through our history of reform and collaboration towards reform, and another part of our reform agenda, another piece of the entire reform picture was the professional pay plan. And we're going to, I should talk a little bit about the professional pay plan, in that we started out back in 1997 thinking about alternative compensation. And again, I was on an AFT task force on alternative compensation. And in that AFT task force, we decided to call it professional pay, because that's we wanted to symbolize what it ought to be, which is professional pay for professional work for professionals. So when we when I started thinking about it and planning, and again we started negotiated a labor management committee on that subject. We decided to call it professional pay, and it, of course, got shortened to pro pay. Mm-hmm. So Denver has Q Comp, and we have pro pay, and it's although it went through several iterations of names. It started out as standards based pay, mm-hmm. and then it went to. Oh, I'm forgetting some of them now. But continuous improvement compensation. Jeez. So you get a kick, CIC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that didn't work. It didn't work with you. It didn't work with the troops. And it was way too long and didn't come trippingly off the tongue. So after several years, it finally ended up the pro pay plan. We believe that the... alternative compensation, although it's now becoming in several locations in this country, not alternative compensation anymore, but the compensation program for teachers, is includes some really excellent research, based on excellent research on professional development, and the committee examined all the research on pay that they could possibly find in the literature on pay. They examined pay in the private sector, and they examined pay in the public, so the history of pay in the public sector. And the committee really did an extensive job of examining what was out there about pay. They then we then included some folks on that committee who were folks who were community members, who were administrators, who were other folks who could think about pay, help us think through the whole pay system. We learned a lot from Denver, but we also learned most, I think, from Douglas County, Colorado.
Really? And, oh, that's right.
And that's Rob Weil.
Yeah.
And that's where Rob got his claim to fame.
Okay.
So when we talk about performance-based pay, we talk about professional pay, we talk about alternative compensation, whatever the term. In this state, the governor calls it QComp for quality compensation. In the legislature called it alternative teacher professional pay system, which is typically a legislative term, which is ridiculous. Anyway, that's what it says in the legislation. But we thought at the time, and I have spoken around the country about professional pay, a wholly different system of pay is kind of the final piece of the professional model that we have been working on since 1985. So it took until approximately 2005 for us to get some of this stuff up and going with a lot of teachers, about 1,900 teachers the first time around. So that took 20 years of developing the professional model. All of the pieces fit together. They were all developed by labor management committees. They're all kept going by labor management advisory committees. They're all kept going by really skilled teacher leaders who are the ones who maintain the programs, grow the programs, keep the spirit and the philosophy of the programs intact, and keep the programs alive. So we believe pretty strongly, and I learned this from Rob Weil, that if you're going to develop a good professional pay program that has that is indeed not just tweaking the old salary schedule, that you really need to build that on a scaffolding or on a foundation of all of the other pieces of the professional model that we've developed. Because you need teachers who can work together, who know how to mentor, who know how to coach each other, who have an idea of what a profession looks like, who have gone through a rigorous tenure process, who have are comfortable with a peer review process, who know what good professional development is and either experience it at their school site or lead it themselves. And all of these pieces of the professional of a model are made whole by the professional pay plan. Now, the professional pay plan, as I said, I spoke for probably the last of 8 years as being the final piece of the professional model. I'm changing my tune now a little bit. I think what we still have not developed enough is professional leadership. Mm. And particularly professional teacher leadership. Now, some places have done it better than we have. Cincinnati has a much better program on teacher leadership, but I think we need to take it one step further and have teachers leading schools. And that's where we are kind of now with New York City, with Philadelphia, with some of the other cities around the country who are trying teacher-led schools, self-governed schools, union schools, whatever you know we call them, developing that kind of teacher leadership and teacher-led programs, instructional leadership teams, and having those be effective at every site. So the instructional leaders, the teacher leaders, are the ones that are actually running the instructional program at the site. So somewhere in there, teacher leadership or professional leadership and professional pay are kind of, I guess, maybe the final two pieces. Mm-hmm. Professional pay we designed after, again, I had been a part of a task force at the AFT on union professional development. That isn't exactly the title of it, but it's close, where we were developing with Joan Snowden the what it was like, what union professional development should look like and how it should be delivered and by whom. And one of the resource folks as a part of the worked with that task force was Tom Corcoran. And Tom Corcoran from CPRE in Pennsylvania. The Tom Corcoran has told us on several occasions his research on good professional development and what it looks like. And good professional development, he said, starts with learning a new skill, a new body of knowledge, a new set of behaviors. Then the second thing is trying them out in a classroom, preferably in your own classroom, and having people observe you, trying them out, and coaching you on that. And then the third piece, to make it yours and to make it stick, is that you reflect on what the results were. You do action research in your classroom to find out whether it really worked or not, and then reflect on that with your colleagues. And in that three-step process, then professional development will be meaningful and it will be time well spent and money well spent, because the results will either tell you this is, as a teacher, this is something that you ought to incorporate in your instructional kit bag, your instructional modus operandi, your or if it didn't work, then you should, it'll tell you to try something else, or to tweak it, or to talk with other teachers and have them try it and observe them doing it. But it will lead you into making it your own. There's been school boards often complain, and unions and teachers complain also, have for years, about the literally billions, with a B, dollars spent on staff development that is absolutely worthless, and it's like pouring money down the drain, because they're one-shot, drive-by professional development. The teachers sit and listen, sit and get only, and it ends there, and there's no follow-up. And what usually happens is, no matter how inspiring or energizing or motivating a one-shot deal is, the tendency is, because teachers are busy people, they take the folder with all the stuff in it back to their classroom, they put it on their desk, and then pretty soon it gets to be the bottom of the pile, and then pretty soon it gets to go in, it's thrown in a drawer, because you have to clean off your desk for open house or something. And then once it gets in the drawer or a file cabinet, it's lost forever, and that's the end of it.
Right.
And so we decided we were going to design our pro pay plan, our professional pay plan, around good professional development, so that it would not only inspire and encourage and instigate and motivate teachers to take a good professional development, which is get the skill, get the new behaviors, get the new philosophy, but also would then require them to go step two. So step one is getting the new skills and knowledge. Step two is actually implementing it in their classroom or at their work site, having somebody observe and do action research on what happened, and then requiring also the reflection as to what happened with colleagues, either through videotaping or through actual classroom observation. So that's called the 1-2-3 plan. Pretty clever, huh?
Yes.
And it has been phenomenally successful, because the teachers don't get the increased pay on their added to their base pay until they have completed all three parts. They've gotten the new skill. They've tried it out. They've done the action research. Their action research has been looked at and scored by some teachers who have been trained and who have inter-rater reliability on what they're seeing in the action research projects, and then the reflection piece. So teachers can do two of those cycles a year if they have enough time and stamina. Usually they don't. Usually they can only do one a year if they do a really good job of it. And the district and the union are the ones who decide what the new skill or knowledge base is that they want the teachers to get. And so only the approved courses can be pro-pay courses. And so there's been and then they get $1,000 added to their base pay after they're completed and it's approved.
So it's a straight 1,000? It's not based on a score?
No, it's a straight 1,000.
Okay.
And that has been going on now for about, I want to say, 5 years or so. Then we added some new wrinkles, and after the pro pay plan was up and really very successful. Before I go on, I should give, for instance, one example is a course called Envoy. And this course on Envoy is a course that teachers take in order to gain additional skills in handling student behavior. And it's a nonverbal communication course in what teachers do in the classroom that either set kids off or calm them down, or how they should gesture, or all kinds of nonverbal communication that affect kids a lot, but teachers, you know, usually don't know.
I think all parents should have that too.
Amen. So that course has been very successful, and the instructor of that course does what she calls a green chair. She takes a little fold-up chair after they've taken the course. Then she takes her little green chair and she goes and sits in that classroom and watches the teachers implement. And it's that kind of instructor follow-up in the classroom, giving pointers in the classroom. She can then, you know, kind of whisper in their ear with some suggestions that are really the most helpful for teachers, because when you get those, the observation and the pointers and the feedback right in the classroom, it's just like with kids. When you get the pointer right then and there, that's when it, you know, it takes. So, and then they do the action research as to what happened with the student behavior. I mean, did it change if they followed up, so they can compare it to a class where they don't use it, or they can compare it to their classroom behavior before they started it. And so that kind of action research with their own kids in their own classroom really, really makes it theirs. Okay, so the next thing that came along that had to do with pay is that we had a state, we have a governor in this state who was enamored of alternative compensation, thought that would make a name for himself and nationally. I think he's now chair of the Education Committee of the Governor's Conference. Or he's on the...
Who's that?
Tim Pawlenty.
He is in there.
He's on the committee anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. So he thought he wanted to kind of make a name for himself. So he put in his budget several... Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. The first thing that happened is that there was a state of Minnesota got a federal grant to try out alternative compensation. And they wanted urban, rural, and suburban districts who were trying out alternative compensation to do a comparative study, since the U.S. Department of Ed only does flat-out comparison studies now. And so they were looking for locals, for school districts to be a part of the grant. It was offered to St. Paul. St. Paul Union turned it down. And so I raised my hand and called up my friends in the Minnesota Department of Ed and say, you know, send us in, Coach. We'd like to try it.
You really are different from St. Paul, aren't you?
Yeah. So it happened then that we were a little late getting in, but we got into the federal grant, and as a result of the federal grant, that meant that we would use our three of our alternative pay sites that were already doing the pro pay as one group, as the comparative group, and then the new sites would be using the teacher advancement program sites, the TAP program.
That's TAP, okay.
And TAP is, we used to say that it was funded by the Milken brothers, but now they've changed that name now to be and National Institute for Excellence in Teaching, NIET. And the TAP program requires that a staff vote to have everybody do performance-based pay, and it includes direct inclusion of the student scores in your own classrooms.
Okay, there it is. I was about to ask, where's the student score?
Right, and they also include scored multiple observations of teachers, and they also include scores of the school-wide gains. It all requires value-added assessment. The reason I thought that some of our sites would be ready for it is that we have a really great director of research, evaluation, and assessment in the Minneapolis schools, and his name is Dave Heisted. And he's been doing value-added assessment in the district for a number of years. And so I think I mentioned once earlier that the teachers really had grown to trust the value-added assessment, at least it wouldn't hurt them. So I called together the sites who were professional development centers, because I thought those sites would be the sites that would have the professional relationships that might allow them to be able to embrace something as new and as, in some ways, scary. Because you can't start a TAP site at a site where the adults don't trust each other, where there's hostility, and that absolutely won't work. So we called called a meeting of the professional development centers and said, here's the grant, here's the TAP program. Are you interested in having a team of teachers at least spend a little bit of time further investigating it and then make a decision as to whether you want to offer it to your whole site? Now, while they were doing that, we were developing the processes or modifying the processes. So we decided that a school site would have to vote by 70% of the staff, of the licensed staff, would have to vote to agree to do the TAP program before they could actually implement it. So the sites, there were several sites that had teams that wanted to present it to their staffs, and the guidelines of the federal grant narrowed it down to size of site and grade levels. So it was offered to several sites, and three immediately voted for it, and those three became the new TAP sites. So we had this TAP sites, we had the ProPay sites, and under the federal grant. After that, we had then came the money from Governor Pawlenty, in which he put money into his budget and convinced the legislature, and we helped convince the legislature that they ought to put some money in the budget to promote what he called QComp, which was included a provision that required that if you were going to do QComp and get state money, that you had to design a pay system that would take teachers off of the salary schedule or the traditional salary grid. Oh. That the traditional salary grid and the traditional steps and lanes, just earning a step because you survived another year and maintained your employment, and moving lanes just based on credit and nothing else, would not be acceptable. So that's when we started trying to put together the ProPay plan, which was our 1-2-3 plan, and the TAP schools, and put it all together under an umbrella under the legislation, which was, again, the governor called QCOMP and the legislation called ATAPS. So we did that, and we have continued to get funding for that now for, I think we're into the fourth and maybe the fifth year. So we have put pretty close to $15 million into Minneapolis teachers' pocketbooks, into their pay, that would not have been there had we just stayed on steps and lanes and not gotten into any of the professional pay issues. All of that money came from external sources. It all went directly governed by the Labor Management Committee on professional pay or alternative compensation. It did not pass go, did not end up in the school district general fund and disappear. It all went directly to teacher pay. Now there's another issue there, in that the reason that we probably 10 years ago now, our lobbyists started saying to me, Louise, because of the population shifts and because of the demographic shifts in this state, the city legislators are eventually, probably sooner than later, are going to lose control. They aren't going to be the heads of committees anymore that suburban legislators are. And once the suburban legislators take over, all of the extra money that the urbans have gotten, because we had powerful people in as head of the Senate Education Committee and head of the Senate Tax Committee and head of the House Education Committee, that all that extra money is going to be in jeopardy. So if you want to get some money into teachers' pockets, you're going to have to figure out some other way to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's when we started investigating, and I had Rob Weil come in. Working with the folks on that AFT task force. We had a subcommittee in the Teacher Union Reform Network on alternative compensation. So we began steeping ourselves in everything we could find and everything we could figure out on our own on alternative compensation, and that's why we started it. Right. So if you think why we started it, what the lobbyists said did come true. And now if you look at, there's $800 million in a categorical fund in the state legislature. It's being used as a political football at the moment, so we'll see if it stays there or not. The legislature that is now back in control of the Democrats, the governor is obviously a Republican, and so they took it out of their budget because they know he wants it in his budget. So we'll see what happens. So, but it's a big issue. It's an issue that I don't believe is going to go away. It's the parents and the community and the business community and just plain folks out there who are citizens and workers themselves believe the logic of having some tie between teachers' pay and how kids do in their classroom. It's logical to them, and it's futile to try to refute that in some ways. So since the politicians and the public want some connectors, and if you think about it philosophically, that we have been like two railroad, the two rails of a railroad track, One rail was what teachers do, and the other rail was what happens to students. But for the first 100 years or so of public education, there were no connectors. There were no ties, the planks between that connected those rails. Now we're finally trying to put those ties in and connect what teachers do with how kids do. And we're doing that through value-added assessment in actually being able to extract how much the teacher actually helps the kids in his or her classroom grow and learn and develop. Mm-hmm. And those are important connectors that we ignored, railed against, and opposed way too long.
Because you're afraid you're going to create a two-tier pay system?
I think teachers were afraid, and still are, that the system would be, that their pay would be based, for instance, on one standardized test, a state test, one shot, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would also be afraid that it was only, for instance, a high school, they see 150 kids, and they only have influence over one student for 55 minutes a day. Other teachers have the rest of the influence. In an elementary school, they have more influence over a group of youngsters for a whole day, but there are lots of other folks who have influence over how that student does. Obviously, teachers are always worried about how the students come into their classroom. So many are so far behind, are so behaviorally discrepant, are so unsupported out in the community and at home, that they worry about those things. So you have to assure teachers, first of all, that all of those things are going to be taken into consideration, and they aren't going to be judged on one shot, one test, one kid, one event, and have their take-home pay based on that. And I think that we're starting to, and partly it's because they don't trust the people who are advocating for that kind of system. Because the folks who are advocating for that kind of system are our traditional enemies,
right,
who aren't supportive of public education usually. And so it's hard for them to really warm up to having somebody who's a traditional, who's not a traditional ally, offer the money. So, you know, some teachers who are base their whole existence on philosophy don't want to think it's dirty money to come from the Millikens and the junk bond kings.
Right.
They think it's not a good idea to accept money from Eli Broad, who likes public charters. They don't think it's a good idea to accept a plan or money from a governor who hasn't been supportive. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, they just say, no, we should not have anything to do with it. But, opportunities sometimes come in very strangely wrapped packages.
Right. Right.
And what we have said from the very beginning with performance-based pay or ProPay or QCOMP or ProComp is the what we know for sure is that teachers need to be the ones developing the systems. So it can't be designed by somebody else. It can't be designed by there are folks who can help, So in Denver, they had a compensation expert on the big committee that helped develop it. And compensation experts are good because they can, you know, help you figure out how to calculate into the future and things like that.
Right.
But the teachers need to be the ones to help design what it's going to look like. And so my sales pitch to the teachers all along has been, look, in this state, QComp is going to happen. And the governor is going to get that funding. And he is going to put it in somebody's pockets. But what we don't want is for the governor to design it, the governor's staff to design it, to have the legislators design it, to have the legislators' staff to design it, because then we know for sure it would be not something that we would like.
See, that's why I see the danger in this. They'll see yours. Let's say Alabama sees yours, says we can do that. They have a weak union system,
mm-hmm.
a weak teacher's voice, and they'll implement it. And it'll be kind of like what happened to the charters.
Well, they did that in Texas. And, of course, the Texas pay system has, you know, collapsed.
Yeah.
Because it was not created by teachers. And, of course, it wasn't embraced by teachers. And so the system has gone down the tubes. So I hope they learn something. Well, they never learn much in Texas, but it's just Texas. But if they were smart in recreating it, they would create it collaboratively with the teachers in Texas, and so that it would be something that would be palatable. It's same thing happened first in Florida.
Yeah.
And so we have evidence. Big evidence, because those are big states with big bucks, and they went down really fast. It didn't take long for them to collapse. So we know that
and Florida has a strong union voice,
right?
And it still didn't work,
right? So
because Bush was putting too much, ignoring the request,
I believe.
Okay,
and I'm not totally sure, but I think that. The legislature and the governor sort of just did it
mm-hmm.
over their objections. So that's why we're working very hard in the AFT, and I'm trying to help them out a little here and there, is wherever they're thinking of or trying to implement now is the federal TIF grants, teacher incentive fund grants, that are some significant grants coming from the federal government that were supported, of course, by the Bush administration and go through the U.S. Department of Ed. And these TIF grants are all around the country now. And those folks who are implementing those TIF grants, again, can either do it well and do it, implement it with good processes, inclusive processes, implement it collaboratively, or they can just do it top down and say this is the way it's going to be and it'll collapse again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're trying to help out some of those TIF sites.
Hmm.
So now the leadership is still elusive. When I said that I thought that in addition to professional pay, professional leadership is one of the final pieces of the professional model. And in the other professions, they have the collaborative, collegial leadership designs, or so that in a law firm, the lawyers in the law firm are the ones who make decisions about leadership, and they're the ones who have a lot to say about how the place is operated and governed. And one of our law firms that labor law firms. That's in your town.
Oh, yeah.
Had some interesting experiences with leadership, and not a few years ago. So that kind of collegial running of the firm and the collegial decision making and the collegial decisions about who leads and what the focus of their work is going to be is something that we still find elusive in education, possibly non-existent. But the one place that it has been happening, or it happened for a number of years, was at the Patrick Henry High School in Minneapolis. And at Patrick Henry High School in Minneapolis, that was the place I described as the professional practice school. But that group of teachers who, the staff of teachers who started that professional practice school, expanded beyond that and developed a teacher leadership model at that school site where they cashed in the assistant principal positions, and they had deans who would take care of all the behavior issues, and then they would have what they call PHILs, which are Patrick Henry Instructional Leaders. Hmm. And PHILs were out of the classroom for generally half a day, and they were the ones that led all the professional programs, all the instructional programs in the site. So the principal was one who was sort of like the, I suppose, the head lawyer in the firm, but the principal was supportive of the model. The principal was worked with the PHILs in the program, but it was one which was, it was not a top-down system of leadership. It was not, I'm the principal, I have the title, I'm the leader.
Right.
And we have gone all over, I've taken them all over the country talking about that teacher leadership model, which is a model that to this day exists hardly anywhere. And
sounds very hard to do. I mean, yeah, the principals who still have the mentality that I'm the boss.
Uh-huh.
You have to find the teachers that have a base core that trust each other to put
right.
the leader up front.
Or develop it. Right.
It sounds like a very unique discipline.
Well, they kept it going, however, over a lot of changes. They actually kept it going over a couple of different changes in principals. And they also have, it's kept it going over lots of changes in staff.
Sure.
And a community has been supportive and important also. And it's always re-examined. It's being re-examined now. But I use that as an example because the kind of teacher leadership that creates that kind of trust is absolutely a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
As rare as hen's teeth. And they're just that kind. That's what we, I believe, need more than anything else is teachers to be trusted, those instructional leadership teams at the site. And we didn't invent that. We copied that from, again, from Cincinnati. I should insert here also that teacher leaders in union leaders in the AFT and in the Teacher Union Reform Network always copy liberally for one another, and we usually with attribution and thanks, but it's rare that you find something that you absolutely create.
Sure.
Out of whole cloth.
Yeah.
So I always try to remember who, had the good idea first. But those instructional leadership teams ought to be leading the instructional program at the site. And I can't tell you the number of sites where it doesn't happen because of the administrators thinking that they're the be-all and the end-all and the final decision-maker, and I can play around with collaboration a little bit, but at the end of the day, I'm the one deciding. And I think that happens partly because what we talked about with our being in separate bargaining units and separate unions and separate, when we separated ourselves out away, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, but they also, there just has been not enough will or belief or training of administrators in this district, in this country, one of the sort of the unsung heroes was my colleague from Dade County. And they, in Dade County, always for a long time had an administrator academy, a principal's academy, and principals had to go through that before they could be a principal in Dade County. It was very good. I don't think it exists anymore.
I think they scrapped it.
Yeah. It was so good they got rid of it. So, leadership is sort of the final frontier.
Right.
We tried developing our own leadership model and our own leadership master's degree program. And when it was all said and done, we could not get sufficiently out of the old training mode of the educational administration training at the higher ed. We couldn't get them out of the mold of sitting and lecturing in a classroom. Instead of what we wanted them to do in this program was to be experiential and actually get out and watch people as they worked in a school,
right,
like facilitating a group meeting or being department head at a school or running a staff meeting at a school or doing professional development at a school. Couldn't ever get, blast them out of the university.
They couldn't get out of the ivory towers?
No.
To do anthropology type work?
No.
Huh.
And saw no reason to do it. So they still wanted the teachers in the class to write the experience up and bring it in, and they discuss it in class.
Right.
It is not the same. No. It just isn't. You can write anything. You can survey your colleagues. You can do whatever you want, but unless you're actually, watch somebody do it, or even simulate the experience. Could have done simulations. So after, I will admit that part of the reason that this particular cohort, which was the Minneapolis Federation, St. Paul, or the University of St. Thomas, St. Paul Public Schools, Minneapolis Public Schools, and the Minneapolis Principals Forum, and all of those groups tried to collaborate on this because we, all wanted to do a better job of training teacher leaders and principals. So the first year was supposed to all be generic leadership skills, mm-hmm, and knowledge. And then they were going to split off one group into teacher leadership and the other group into getting their principal's license. So the first year, the group kept asking me to come back about every other month saying, okay, now if we choose the teacher leadership path and we go that direction where we really want to go, because we want to continue to be teachers, we want to continue to have the connection with the classroom, but we want to go into get teacher leadership roles, what is that going to get us? And I never had an answer. because we hadn't embedded in the contract or in the requirements for any of the leadership jobs in any of this professional model, we hadn't embedded this master's degree in teacher leadership as a requirement.